All right, welcome everybody. I am here with the Oracle of London, Alexander Mercuris, and the great Robert Barnes. Mr. Barnes, where can people find you?
The best place is vivabarneslaw.locals.com.
All right, let's get into Cuba. Let's talk Cuba, everybody. There were protests a couple weeks ago. Now there's crackdowns going on, online and offline. Robert, what is going on in Cuba? Let's open this up. What's up with Cuba?
I mean, I still have friends that are there for the last, and I've been there on and off for the last 20 years or so, give or take. And I think from both the left, it's one area where, particularly in the West, definitely in the United States, it's very hard to get objective perspectives because you have the people who, the Cubans in Miami, who have such intense hostility to the regime, understandably so, but that tends to sort of blind all their analysis. Everything's bad, everything's terrible, nothing's good ever, everything's political, et cetera. And then, unfortunately, you have this kind of reflective view of large parts of the left from the old Soviet era that somehow is still vestigially around, where they're not doing, you know, the Cuban government's really not doing anything wrong. It's just the U.S. embargo is the only thing to blame. And the short answer is Cuba was not a country that could afford to do a lockdown for a year. Similar to like South Africa, Colombia, maybe you could argue Tunisia, some of these other places that not everybody can make the money machine go burr like the United States and some of the West have done. And sort of prop everybody up. Cuba became really dependent on tourism, especially as not only escape valve, if, you know, for its domestic population that's entrepreneurial, that's unhappy with the limitations of the current economy, but also just for the economy in general. I mean, after they had what they called, they had some little phrase, the special time in the early 90s, the tourism is what saved them. In particular, diverted energies that might have turned against the regime. But you shut down the economy and tourism, especially for a year, for a country that can't print its way out of its problems, that was already struggling, that I think, I mean, last I checked, they had half or so the sugar production in the 80s is what they, I mean, they just haven't been able to remain, without the Soviet sugar daddy, they have not been able to sustain certain industries. They couldn't afford this. And so I knew the stress level even before the protests were rising. They have a political expression, but they're not political in origin. In other words, these are not people sitting around saying, I want this constitutional change, I want this reform. It's not like that precisely. It's we want food and we don't have enough of it. It's we want medicine and we don't have enough of it. It's we want some basic economic freedoms, and because of the lockdowns, we don't have those either. But once there ended up being a food problem and an energy problem. There's always been an energy problem in Cuba, rolling blackouts for the last decade and a half, but it got really bad. I mean, you have people in the middle of summer who can't put their fan on. They don't even have air conditioning, but can't even put their fan on all night. It's little things like that that the Cuban government under the Castros used to always make sure the lights were on at some level, the fans would work, enough would work so that they would minimize hostility of the domestic population. They forgot that, and they don't have the personal charisma of the Castros to salvage them, particularly Fidel. Whatever his controversy, there was always a part of the Cuban, particularly the older population, that he was a very charismatic figure. This regime has nobody like that. It's kind of like when we went from Chavez to Maduro in Venezuela. That was not going to be a favorable shift for the regime. And then, on top of all of that, you have the core political problems that have always been present that just continue to run amok in terms of not having enough basic economic freedoms. And it's what Fidel himself said over a decade ago when they asked him, are you going to export the Cuban model to the world like you've been trying in the past? And he said, no, it doesn't work for Cuba. So why would we try to export it anywhere? So even Castro acknowledged that. And now with a Castro-less Cuba that couldn't afford to shut down, right on the teetering on the edge already, the problems are serious and severe because everybody knows if you take to the streets in Cuba, you might get locked up for 3 years. And they did it anyway. And that's why it's very rare. And for them to do it means the stress level is burgeoning. And the whole population, when they did a poll in 2015, it's decently reliable, not perfectly reliable. You can assume all the people that said no opinion really had a negative opinion of the regime. But massive gaps by age. So the older generation still believed in the revolution. anybody born after 1980 does not. Now, the only limitation to all of this is they really think that if the regime changed, all of Cuba will look like Miami. They think it will have that level of wealth, that level of success. That's not necessarily very realistic. And crime and other things will skyrocket once those kind of changes take place. There were real achievements in health, education, and crime by the Cuban regime. You can argue whether the means they chose were not worth the price it paid, and then there are a lot of problems, of course. But with those benefits are not as strong enough to sustain it when you can't provide food and medicine. And the reason they couldn't provide food and medicine is because they chose to embargo food and medicine to the country for whatever reason. It's this regime is more about power and control than it is mitigating harm, whereas Castro was always a bit of a mixed bird. And so I think that we may be seeing the beginnings of the death throes of the Cuban regime, but it's not quite the pure politically motivated vision that some of the critics of the regime say.
Is there anything the regime can do to sort of sustain itself? I mean, I have to say, its capacity for survival has frankly astonished me. I mean, I have to say this, and I was saying this to Alex before. I mean, I used to be very much of a lefty, but I was never particularly taken it. I don't know why, but for some reason, Cuba, I never had this sort of romantic feeling about Cuba that so many left-wing people still do. But it always struck me that, you know, it built up lots of things. It built up its education system. It built up its health service system. But all of that was largely because it was getting all that money from the Soviets. And there was a lot of help from the Soviets. Then that all went away. And somehow this thing continued to tick along in some fashion, even though, I mean, practically the cost of so much of what it's trying to do must be very great. And when you see all these pictures of Havana, you know, this sort of very run-down place, I've never been there, but people who have tell me that it is absolutely as run-down as it looks. That tells me, at least to me, that there is a great shortage of funding in Cuba. There's absolutely no spare money to spend, even on the most basic things. And that tells me a completely dysfunctional economic system, one that must be riddled with waste from top down, and one which may be struggling also to sustain its health and education sectors. So it's amazed me that this thing has managed to keep going for as long as it has done. I mean, was that the charisma of the Castros? Was it authoritarianism? Was it fear that, you know, Uncle Sam is going to come in and take over the island and bring it all under control? I mean, what was it? I mean, what kept it going for as long as it has done?
I think it's a bifurcated thing. I think some of what Castro would attribute it to, I don't necessarily agree with, but he and, in terms of strategy, don't agree with it politically, but that's a different thing. Both he and Che concluded from Allende's being overthrown in Guatemala, Che being there, and Castro watching it in 1952, was that an open society was the great danger to the revolution. So that's why he would never allow an open society, even though his famous speech, "History will acquit me" or "History will absolve me," however, whatever language you use, which you could find in Cuba everywhere, which was kind of ironic because he talks about the lack of freedom of press. But he had a different view then than he did by the time he came back. The Allende experience sort of combined with interacting with Che convinced him that the three keys to sustaining power, one was making sure your generals and key police officers are with you. And keeping out problematic people, keeping out the power freaks, the abusers, etc. The second was preventing an open society, no free press, no free association, no free political movement, no free parties, mass surveillance state, which they launched from the very beginning. You can't live in a single, they assign your housing in Cuba. You get to own your home, kind of. You can't sell it, but you own it, right? But in every apartment building or every block, there's a government person that's been assigned to watch everyone else. This is also why crime was difficult, right? You can't just show up with a new TV because they're going to rat you out in 5 seconds because where'd you get the new TV? There's no, you know, there's no differential in wages enough to justify that unless you're a doctor or something. So the and similarly, their borders are so tight, no drug problems, no alcohol problems because you can't import the drugs. And the alcohol is so expensive, it costs you a month's salary to buy one bottle of rum. And so that's a, you know, group celebration once a month kind of thing. But it did have the side benefit of no alcoholism, no drug abuse problems, very little crime. What he did well was early on he delivered for the rural population that was the real foundation, in his view, of the revolution. So he delivered a little bit more control over their own everyday labor, and then, of course, education for their kids and healthcare. Which so that's why a lot of the older generation, particularly from Santiago and all the rural areas outside of Havana, most of the protest and criticism of Havana, Castro always came from Havana. And then of that population, about 1 out of 5 people in Havana fled within 5 years. So, you know, the people who didn't like Castro left the country. So the I think half of your doctors and dentists, that's why he had a human capital problem when he took over by the mid-60s. And where they invested well was in human capital, labor and medicine and education, that you could teach a lot of people those skill sets and that could solve a lot of the core everyday problems of people. And then he guaranteed employment. I mean, there is no homelessness. I forget their phrase, but basically it's making sure everybody has just enough. And that he mostly achieved. Now, initially heavily, as you note, with the help of the Soviet Union. Soviet Union collapsed in 1989. Within 4 or 5 years, 2/3 of their sugar production fell. I mean, they couldn't do it without Soviet support. And that's where they've been a total failure. I mean, Che thought they were going to create a new Cuban man and all this stuff, and they were going to industrialize Cuba. This was the the Castro goes to Soviet Union thinking they're going to send him all the things to build these massive, beautiful factories. Of course, that didn't come about at all. But Castro was always good at, he had personal charisma, and he was always good at shifting. And there was part Castro communist, part Castro old school Latin left populist. He was always a hybrid with him. And he always had that streak where he stayed, if he thought the public was really getting too stressed, he would do dramatic shifts. And he never wanted to show off conspicuous consumption. He hates it. He was obsessed with that. That's why the regime might have wealth, but it looks like 14th century Venice. It's all inside. None of it's outside. Or 14th century Florence. You can't. You wouldn't show it. Couldn't display it. And he was fearful of tourism because he believed that the Cuban population would see all this wealth and it would create conspicuous consumption and class division and conflict and so forth. But ultimately, he bit the bullet. And there he brought in the Spanish to invest heavily in creating. He realized they couldn't create the hotels. They couldn't create the tourism industry overnight. And he went along with it. Where, frankly, they should have done the same. I mean, this is where the embargo is not a problem. There's no embargo on food anyway. There's no embargo on medicine anyway. There's no embargo on the internet anyway from the United States. And Cuba can trade with the whole world. The government is more scared of losing power. So they won't do a deal on sugar, for example. And that's where they could go in with, they could go in with Russia. They could go in with tons of people to help them develop and get their sugar production back to where it was. It could be triple where it is currently. That would save a lot of their problems. They just refused. Now, they bought time again, bought time initially in the mid-90s with opening up to tourism, bought time again with Chavez coming into Venezuela. They exported their doctors, and basically Venezuela gave them free oil, effectively, very, very cheap. So it kept their economy afloat for about a decade. And it was then Obama really helped. But when Obama lifted a lot of things, there was a ton of influx. It was easy to send in money to the Cuban government. And that's the other thing people misunderstand. The embargo is just on the Cuban military. It's not on the Cuban population. But what is the Cuban military won't allow any money into the country that doesn't go through it first. The Cuban government, however you want to put it. And they started putting in weird rules. They got more paranoid after Fidel was dead and Raul stepped back. The statists that have control of that system are much closer to Maduro than they are to Chavez. They're the same mindset. There's no left populist streak at all. There's no deep ties to the soldiers and the cops on the street. Corruption in the cops started popping up in ways it never did just a couple of years ago. You started seeing fissures left and right. The class divisions that emerged because they're allowing a small tourism industry. And it was a great way to shift capital. And the thing with Cuba is fascinating. The insides of the buildings are like they focus solely on safety of the buildings. So the buildings look terrible because they have done no aesthetic repairs whatsoever on the outside. But on the inside, the buildings are all fundamentally safe, they're safer than, say, the Dominican Republic. I felt much safer in Cuba than I did in the Dominican Republic, both in terms of infrastructure and in terms of people. They did a very good job for kids, totally safe. You can play, you can do whatever you want. Totally good job for elderly for the most part. The key problem was shrinking economy. I mean, and they partially solved that problem by, like, talking about tough immigration laws. Then Cuba ain't invited no Haitians or Jamaicans in. You know, they're almost as bad as the Dominicans are towards the Haitians. And they have let about 100,000 people leave a year because they want the population to stay flat because they haven't figured out a way to increase productivity of resources with the state model. And it's what they should have done. Tourism bought them some time, money coming back. But like, for example, the reason why it's hard to send money directly to Cubans currently, it's not that hard. It's, you know, you send it to one person, they get it to them. It's not that difficult. But it's solely because the Cuban government won't allow any money to come into the country through PayPal or anything else that doesn't first go through a Cuban military-controlled bank. They won't allow their population to receive it. But so this regime is much more control-oriented, whereas the prior regime was a little bit more balanced. Castro had an eye to make sure the soldiers are okay, make sure the military's okay, and make sure the populace isn't squeezed too much. Like one example, he would rather guarantee employment than make sure people did productive employment. So it became very clear in the 90s and 2000s that they needed to develop a domestic construction industry. But nobody wanted to work construction jobs because you'd get paid the same thing as you'd walk into a museum and there'd be like 17 people in one room on one floor because that's all their job. Because more obsessed with, hey, we guarantee full employment, even if it's utterly unproductive employment. And nobody's like, why am I going to work construction? I'm not going to work construction out in the sun. Screw that. I can just stay here. So and that's where Castro was not your pure totalitarian like some of the critics put out. He wasn't power driven in that way, in the same way. I always called him, when I was down there, I called him Papa Fidel. So he was a little tyrannical of a certain kind, but he saw it as protective and saw it as, like a lot of his crazy things he did with his show trials, he learned from the rural countryside in terms of retributive policies. That's why he was so anti-gay through the 70s and 80s. He borrowed a lot of the rural countryside, where he himself had grown up in part, and applied it consequently. But without Castro, with the statist in control, without the ability to develop their sugar economy and willing to take the bait on bringing in foreign investment, foreign direct capital, they were always going to be in trouble, and they were a country that could not afford to lock down. And they have a whole generation, two generations now, that don't believe in the revolution at all. I mean, they don't believe in the core assumptions of the revolution. They want multi-party systems. They want open systems. Because what Castro said was right. He said, as soon as we allow internet and as soon as we allow tourism, people are going to figure out they can do something different and are going to organize to do so. And that's why while he was alive, they never had free internet throughout Cuba. And that's why he bit the bullet begrudgingly on tourism, because he knew what it would interject. Now, the only downside is you have a huge bunch of young people that really think their country, they will look like rich tourists as soon as they get rid of the regime. So there's going to be some bitter disappointment if that ever does happen. You know, the risk of an East European Russia style transition 1990s is very high in Cuba. Crime would skyrocket in that place the moment the state collapses. So that's the downside to the if it's not managed correctly. But this regime does not have their finger on the pulse at all. The only thing that's saving them is all these neocon regime change Bushite wing of Republicans yipping so much. That is a huge gift to them. They love showing, hey, look at what they're tweeting today. Look at what they're saying on media today. Look at their rally today. They don't. I mean, why they? I get it's placating the Cuban population in Miami, but it does not help the Cubans actually in Cuba. It hurts them to be associated with the Ted Cruzes of the world.
Yeah, you made that same point, Alexander, during a video we did on Cuba a couple weeks ago. That same exact point that Robert made. You said the same thing. The neocons are actually helping the Diaz-Canel. That's the president, the regime. Yeah, Diaz-Canel. Yeah.
He's got like. He's got a decent look, but the guy is just, you know, he's so corporate statist. He just reminds me a lot of Maduro, a little more charismatic than Maduro, but nowhere near Castro. Like if that had happened when Fidel, and it did happen a little bit in the early 90s, Castro went right out into the streets himself. I mean, he had a different level of charisma, whether you hated him or not. The guy just had a magnetism, particularly in Cuba with the bird flying off when he was, first came into Havana, had all these mystical meanings and all of that jazz. So he had a good finger on his pulse of the Cuban populace. Though they all thought he was like secretly rich and had 15 homes and was really a billionaire and had, I mean, they would take me around everywhere and say, oh, that's a secret home and that's a secret home and that's a secret home. And what I think he never fully appreciated is a closed society produces the greatest degree of skepticism about the state and the system. They believed every crazy thing they heard about him. It's like, and some of which was true, but half of it was totally not the case, especially the idea that they're all going to be like, the wealth of Miami will magically show up in all of Cuba if the government just falls, which is not quite realistic.
No, it seems to me that it isn't just the neocons who are helping the regime. In a way, I mean, the embargo is just a propaganda thing, essentially. I mean, the Cuban regime talks about the embargo to explain away the economic problems. But from what you've said, it doesn't really matter as much. And I have to say this. I mean, this is something which I've felt for a very long time. I mean, I'm not quite sure what exactly it is that the embargo does that is so difficult for Cuba. All right, they couldn't sell their cigars to the US and their rum. They don't make as much sugar as they did anyway. But, I mean, given the kind of political choices they've been making since the 60s, I mean, trade with the US would have fallen off a cliff anyway, it seems to me. So what real difference is the embargo actually making?
I mean, at this point, you know, it might squeeze a little bit of the government's cash that they would otherwise get from U.S. direct sources, but it's not clear to me how much of that there is. Because really, like, you know, with the Cuban, it's not like they don't have satisfaction of the current Cuban cigar market, for example, or the coffee market, or the sugar market, or the rum market. So maybe they could increase prices? I don't think. I mean, you look at the European prices, I don't see any evidence of that. If anything, price pressure probably would go the other way. Because right now they benefit from the fact that, you know, these cost extra because you can't get them straightforward here. I'm not sold that the embargo achieves anything. I'm a skeptic of sanctions in general. You know, the only argument I've ever seen is maybe South Africa benefited from sanctions, but, you know, there's some other issues.
I think that's wildly overstated, by the way. I mean, having been very much involved
in
the
regime that had massive debt that was always going to implode. It was imploding. That's why they gave it to Mandela. That whole thing was falling apart. They're like, we're out of here. See you later. Good luck. they thought the whole thing would collapse. And somehow, to his credit, he salvaged it despite getting brutal criticism, you know, called it neoliberal and all the rest, even though he actually kept the IMF out for managed to do it during that time frame. I think he achieved more than was given credit for. But basically, yeah, I don't think it achieves much. I think they think, okay, look, we're preventing direct cash going right to the Cuban military. But it's not clear because you can circumvent it. For example, if people want to get money to their friends or family in Cuba, they just go a circuitous route. And the Cuban military still gets their piece. In fact, all it is you're spending more money for additional layers of administrative bureaucracy. That's it. And less money goes to the person it's intended for because of the embargo. So it's not clear to me the embargo solves that problem in terms of squeezing the Cuban military. It's not clear it solves any how much tourism. I mean, probably the biggest impact would be you would see a surge of American tourists to Cuba. You saw some of that when it became easier, but it wasn't quite the scale that a lot of people thought it would be back under Obama. So particularly, and I think that's because this, you know, they don't have as good of a tourism economy as they could because it's so state run. Every state restaurant is crap. The hotels they allow someone else to manage, even though it's in the name of the state, are really well run. The Airbnbs are well run. The private restaurants are off the charts, fantastic now. But the private tour guides, because your tour guide will be somebody with a master's degree in like art and this, and they might even be a medical doctor because they make more money showing you around Havana or Santiago or wherever else. So, yeah, I think it's not clear. I agree with you. It provides more political cover for the Cuban regime than it puts pressure on the Cuban regime. I mean, because you had people like Crystal Ball and people like Kyle Galinsky who really believed that the embargo was the reason food is not there and medicine's not there, even though it has nothing to do with it at all. And that's why the Cuban population now did know. They're like, you put an embargo on this, you, the Cuban government. But I agree that it more negative than positive. I don't see how it has net plus. It's more symbolic to make the Cuban population feel good in Miami about being angry at the regime there. But I don't think it achieves that much at all. And probably is there's a few positives, but there's probably a lot more negatives in the end.
Why is the country short of food? Why are there these food shortages all the time? I mean, it should be rich. If they're not growing sugar, you know, they could be growing food, it seems to me. But I mean, is agriculture collectivized there? I mean, I used to smoke cigars. I still do from time to time. There was a cigar, you may know it, the Don Alejandro, which it turned out was a Vega Robaina, that there is apparently a person who actually grew his own tobacco. Well, I didn't know that happened in Cuba. But, I mean, is that common? Is there a lot of that going on in Cuba? I mean, what is the problem with the agricultural system that it can't feed people?
It shows an extraordinary failure on their part. Now, part of it is they got into a certain relationship with the Soviet Union through the 70s and 80s that undermined self-development in Cuba. So because I was like, okay, we'll provide this and you're going to provide that. And we'll provide and so forth, rather than a self-sustaining agricultural model. But the second problem is the collect. Now, there are some individual farmers and they go back and forth in terms of the degree to which you get to control your own farm or you're part of a collective. But it's striking to me. It's like industrialization is one area where collectivization can say that it was not a total failure. You know, it was like in the Soviet Union, they were able to industrialize, stayed their gap between us and between the Soviet Union and the United States stayed relatively steady. At some points it went up, some points it went down. But the failure, they didn't have a failure to industrialize. But in almost every communist society I know of, they have not been able to collectivize agriculture effectively. You end up with famines almost everywhere. Whether it's Ethiopia, China, Ukraine, you name it. So sooner or later, they end up with a famine of some type. And Cuba's been the same. They thought if they after the Soviet Union collapsed, if they reduced the amount of sugar production, they would replace it with chicken and rice, and it hasn't worked. Because at the end of the day, it really requires an entrepreneurial, ownership-driven model for agriculture to work, is at least my conclusion. You may be able to collectivize it corporate-wise, but they haven't been able to collectivize it state-wise without some capital infusion. Like, I mean, the key to the Soviet Union wasn't just the purchase of sugar, the guaranteed price support, but also they provided a lot of the industrial equipment to make sure it worked and operated well. And there, that's a place where they can make an argument that if they could get U.S. equipment of certain times, it would be easier. But the reality is they can always get the U.S. equipment from Canada or Mexico or someplace else. So it's not like it's that hard. At the end of the day, they prefer control. But I think it's the collectivization of agriculture has been a constant, continuous failure for them. Because like once they started allowing little restaurants to open, they went from having some of the worst restaurants in the world to some of the best restaurants in the world just by allowing private owners to exist.
I mean, what you're basically saying to us, Robert, and I think this is absolutely what I suspected is the case, but I mean, you're putting all the flesh on it, is that the fundamental problems that Cuba has are actually the legacy of Castro's model. I mean, you can point to its achievements, and they are, I mean, you know, they are real, and the educational system, and we shouldn't discount those things. I mean, if one lives in many places around the world which don't have good education, don't have good healthcare. You know, the absence of those things matters, and the achievement of those things matters. But it looks to me like the country at the moment, or up to now, has been trapped inside a system that it can't really dismantle, because it's worried that if it dismantles it, the whole thing will just go smash. And at the same time, which is freezing it and just won't let it grow or revolve or develop in any way. I mean, that seems to me the problem. It is the political system and the economic system that has been created out of it.
Exactly. I mean, the way I used to do it is the left populist side of Castro was what was successful. making education fully available, making investing in human capital and certain skill sets, like in medicine, like in the pharmacy industry, and investing in basic levels of food supply and education and medicine. And that was really the left populist side. That nothing about being a collectivist or communist required that method. That's just anything any good government should do, in my view. Whereas all of the communistic side really never worked outside of being part of the Soviet Union's extended empire. And so, I mean, it worked in that sense. He had a sugar daddy that could take care of everything in the 70s and 80s. Cubans traveled freely to Eastern Europe. They had no other tourism of any kind. They didn't see any alternative society outside of other communist societies. And he did create, and crime is a place, but I mean, there's a great price you pay for that. Mass surveillance state and no economic opportunity. But, you know, if you take away all economic opportunity and spy on everybody, yes, you can indeed reduce crime dramatically. But, you know, that has, whether that's worth it or not, another story. But yes, you're correct. I mean, other than the populist side, other than the crime side, everything else never worked. And he himself acknowledged this in 08, 09. He had that accident in 04, so he was behind the scenes because he had such pride. He didn't want to be seen limping around all the time. But everybody kind of knew Fidel, even though Raul was formerly in charge, that was still Fidel's show until Fidel was dead and in the ground. And it wasn't long after that that Raul was like, I'm done, I'm out of here. And so he was part of the revolution, but nothing like Fidel. Didn't have anywhere near the charisma nor the deep commitment to it. And so, and this new regime basically has all the down, doesn't have any of the charisma, doesn't have any of the populist legacy, doesn't value it, frankly. I mean, they should value it more in terms of the medicine, the education, other aspects. They don't. And they instead only value the control. They see they're using the bugaboo of the embargo as their pretext to continue to escalate levels of control. But it's another place that could not, the other thing the left should have realized, they thought because Cuba put strict immigration controls and strict other controls in, they prevented AIDS from coming to Cuba. And so they've always said that was one of their great achievements, that AIDS never hit the island very hard. And they saw this as a second opportunity to justify the state. Look at how we protected you from scary COVID. COVID's not AIDS. So it was never going to translate in the same way. And especially a population that's eager to overthrow things and is tired of it. The reality is this, basically what you summarize, the Cuban economic model, the collectivist model, has failed two generations and they're tired of it. And the lockdown just brought it all to a head. And how long they can survive is a real open question. I don't see them surviving 5 years.
That's very interesting. I mean, that's really going to be enormously interesting. And we'll see what comes afterwards. It looks like Cuba, the model for Cuba, was one created around the personality of Fidel Castro. With him gone, it's lost its purpose in a way. It can't really function without him. I'm just going to finish with one thing about Castro, which is, you know, I once went to Granma, almost unreadable, but you've got there the reflections of Fidel, which I was reading. And one of the things that really struck me about this is that he has very little to say about economics, actually. I mean, he is all about, Angola and the war there and what is going on in Bolivia and Argentina and, you know, all that sort of thing. And I always got the impression, ultimately, that economics, the actual business of getting meat on people's table, ultimately bored him. I don't know whether this is, you know, a true reflection of the man, but it perhaps explains some of the eccentricities of this system he's bequeathed to the country.
Yes. I think that that's very true. I mean, and he never understood it. He never got it. It was never his thing. His thing was rhetoric. His thing was politics. His things were speeches, of course. He could go for 4 or 5 hours. But his thing was never the details of economics. He what his great credit was is he had a politician's ear in the sense of paying a tune to the public. So he knew if things were getting a little out of whack, if things were going a little stray. He paid great attention to his soldiers and his cops to make sure they were okay. But the second and purged them of bad actors. But he kept his finger on the pulse, so he only responded economically when the public started really expressing higher and higher levels of dissent. And that's where he was good at intervening and recognizing when that was to keep it down. But he had nowhere near the same appeal with the younger generation that didn't have the revolutionary imagery. People who take things for granted. They think every place is low crime. I mean, they think a lot of this. I mean, it's fascinating, some of their assumptions. Things that they have in their life that are good, they take for granted. The things they don't have in their life are the things they focus on that they know they could have but for the regime. But I never thought the regime could survive a decade past Fidel's death. It's sort of like the Venezuela regime, and it wasn't going to survive past Chavez, in part because of the lack of charisma of the individuals involved, but also in part because what you point out is exactly correct. The legacy they bequeathed was a system that couldn't sustain itself. And that was the ultimate failure of Fidel, which he kind of acknowledged toward the end of his life. We have a system that doesn't work for Cuba, so why would we export it to the world? Well, the same question can be of the Cuban government. Why are they continuing a system that even Castro said doesn't work for its own people?
Interesting. Very, very, very interesting. Gosh, so much to see there. I hope something comes out of the wreck. I mean, I do, as I said, enjoy my old Cuban cigars. So I hope those will continue. But I hope also for the Cuban people. I mean, you said that they might face terrible disappointments and things. I hope that can be mitigated in some way. But we shall see. I don't know, Alex, have you anything to add to all of this? I mean,
I have one question. Do you know the situation, Robert, with the internet and online information? Because I do understand that it's actually pretty strange that the people in Cuba were not allowed access to the open internet, especially during the protests. So big tech comes in and actually provides much of the information that was deprived for them, which is really interesting when you see big tech is actually censoring people in the United States, but in Cuba, they're trying to open the internet up. Is that true? Did big tech come in and try to open things up? And do you have a feel for what the internet is like in Cuba?
Well, what I loved about Cuba from a vacation perspective, the local population didn't, was that your phone didn't work and there was no internet for most of the time I originally visited. You could go to the hotel and get 30 minutes access to like an old, slow speed, you know, send the occasional email, but you were really off the grid. Castro was big on no internet. He was like, I'm not letting people talk like this with each other. And what's interesting is the current regime that was real gung-ho on the internet. Now, and to give you an example of how intense it was, once they had it, I used to go to the parks, and those parks, they would all get together, like along the Malecon. They would have, you know, their bottles of rum, and everybody would just hang out right by the water, and just beautiful. And then all these, they have gorgeous parks all the way through Havana. And the but the last time I was there was not long after internet had really been allowed. You'd go to the park, and what it was is the key places that had the best internet access were at the parks. And everybody was just sitting around, not looking at each other, not talking to each other on their phones. So on the internet, they love the internet in Cuba. It's their biggest thing in the world. And they don't really restrain themselves. Like a lot of, I thought, you know, I would track different people and people would say political speech. I was like, that's interesting. And they didn't really control speech every day in the streets, but there was no free press at all. You just couldn't you could badmouth the regime as long as you weren't doing it with a bullhorn. But the internet changed that ball game. I mean, this rally, this protest never would have happened but for the internet. And so they were going to shut that down right away most within 3 days, at least people that I know there, free communication all of us, again. So I thought maybe they would really restrain it, really clamp down. They did some mass arrest, there's rumors of people getting shot. That's probably not all that likely. There may be a couple of examples of that, but that's really not the regime. I mean, what the other thing Castro did well was he picked his soldiers and cops well. He avoided the psychopaths, the kind of people that, you know, the Batista regime showed up here, and then they showed up in drug deals and foreign assassinations. And, you know, the Felix Rodriguez's of the world had an interesting post-Cuban American history. But Castro was very careful about that. It was one of the smart things he did. He understood your police military needed to not be your psychopaths. He even had this whole theory about 1 out of 20 people are going to be sociopaths, how you screen them out, all this stuff. That he was skilled at. He was more narcissistic than even there. He wasn't that narcissistic. He was just a guy who had a certain vision. He thought he should Papa Fidel. He should run the world. And if you don't understand that, that's a little bit of a problem for you then. You know, that was the mindset. But the internet is real. It's strong there now. And yes, the Cuban regime still keeps strict control over access to it. And yes, there are people but you have big tech technologies like Facebook, you know, like WhatsApp, like Twitter, You have some of these things are available in Cuba, which are fascinating, which are actually much more free space zone areas. But that's where, like, all these people that think they're helping the revolution by being on the neocon high profile. I'm going to tweet. Mercedes Schlapp is out there, you know, tweeting away. You know, her husband is the head of CPAC. That does not help the regime. There's nobody down in Cuba saying, I can't wait for Mercedes Schlapp to say I'm right. Whereas there's plenty of people saying, please don't say anything to make us look like a bunch of U.S. stooges. But they'll use the internet control, mass arrest. Those will be their two techniques to try to suppress. But if they want to really suppress, they need to reopen the economy, get tourism back going again, do something about they already did lift their embargo on food and medicine right away. Why they had that, it was all about control. It was just, we don't want this coming in from this source because this will endanger our control in this region or this part of the population. But it was the same reason they didn't, like, the reason why they don't have a COVID vaccine is because they want to develop their own, which I thought was good, by the way, for its own reasons. But putting that aside, that they thought they would develop it faster. There was all these puff pieces about 6 months ago. Cuba will have the best vaccine. Well, of course, it didn't turn out that way, which might be revealing about the vaccine, but that would be a non-YouTube story to talk about. But that's the only reason why Cuba doesn't have a vaccine is because, again, or a successful rollout is because of that. But the people down there are really paranoid. The Cuban government has convinced the local population that this is the equivalent of the Black Plague that they just saved them from. And they believe that more because of no tourism. But the only counter to it has been actually their access to the internet with critics and skeptics of the system is the only way they would know to say, hey, this isn't as bad as people say it is. But that's the current stats. The internet has been a freeing source of power, democratic empowerment in Cuba.
Interesting. Can I just ask one question, Robert? What about the military now and the security forces? How reliable are they? I mean, if there was a crisis, would they stand by the regime? Is there any possibility of a coup?
There definitely is a possibility because the military is so, like, unlike a lot of other militaries. One, the military is huge. So I mean, it's very big. Police force, huge. That when I first time I went down to Cuba, these Cubans would joke with me. He said, "You're totally safe. For every one Cuban, there's four police officers." So that was the crock. So but they were the nicest police officers and soldiers I'd ever met at every level. They're like super friendly. I was like, where in the world did they get their training? They're unlike any cops or military I've ever dealt with in my life. So they're much more accessible, but that makes the regime much more vulnerable on the other side. Because they are responsive to the local population. So if the population is, if their cousin, their sister, their parents, their kids, if they're experiencing too much economic stress, then the military, then those soldiers will, those sergeants, because that's how Fidel won. I mean, that's the reason why he was so sensitive to it. He didn't win because he won a military conflict. He won because Batista's military quit. Because the sergeants were like, screw this, we're out of here. The only reason why Fidel stayed alive was because of that Santiago sergeant that kept him alive when Batista was trying to get him whacked. But without Castro's personal touch, with all these statists he's put in behind him, I think that they are more out of tune with the line level soldier and sergeant and police officer than they are much more attuned to the broader public than your typical military is. So they're much more vulnerable to collapse, to that collapse being a quick collapse, because all the real power is the cop on the street and the sergeant. Whatever they decide is how Cuba's going to go. And as long as Fidel was around, that was very little risk. Now that risk just keeps going up, 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 and up, as long as they don't satisfy and satiate the population's needs, but core needs. They don't have to give them everything. Just basic food, medicine, and a little bit of economic opportunity, and they'd be able to survive. But I don't think they're smart enough to recognize that.
Yeah, it seems so. It seems so. I mean, I have to say, I've been reading I've been trying to read Granma, and I have to say, I don't get the sense there of a regime that has much imagination. Actually, I mean, they seem to be falling back on control mechanisms rather than trying to look for a way forward, to strategize forward.
Wow. And they really think, because of the left in the States, that they can just scream embargo. They really thought the local population would be on their knees thanking them for saving them from COVID. That's what they really believed. And it was like, I mean, like one of the, they took away, you could not go to the Malecon for the last year. This is the main place in Havana that everybody goes to blow off steam, hang out, chat, you know, get together on the weekends. They would do it every Thursday, Friday, Saturday night, you know, especially when when it was hot, you get the breeze off the ocean. To take away a communal experience like that to where the only thing you have is the internet was showed a lack of tactical understanding of their own population. And I don't see that changing anytime soon. Fidel just left a bunch of statists in charge, just like Chavez left Maduro in charge. This regime is bound to fail. It's only a matter of time and whether the neocons can keep their mouths shut long enough to help it happen.
Interesting. Listening to you speak, Robert, it's interesting because everything you were talking about with Castro was about Castro, and then everything about the regime, you're using the word regime. And you too, Alexander, it's everything, the regime. But regime. Castro, it was Castro.
There was something more, definitely. I mean, I remember Fidel very well. I mean, internationally. I mean, he was a personality. He was a character, as we say in Britain. I mean, he really was. And I mean, undoubtedly, he did have extraordinary charisma. As I said, it wasn't something that I completely understood myself, but I could see the effect that it had even at a distance. I mean, there was a kind of romantic quality to it, which.
Well, it's on a personal level, too. Yeah. I mean, you know, you're talking about a person, Castro, and people can relate to another person. You know, you talk about Trump or Putin. People are relating to the person. But when you use the word regime.
Regime, exactly. You get a completely different image of faceless officials. And that's, it seems, essentially what we have.
Exactly. I mean, Castro was like one of the old great Southern populist in America. You know, your Huey Longs, your Jim Folsoms, your just like Donald Trump, like a Putin today, just a very rare, like a Nelson Mandela. That would have been a comparison. I mean, just someone who had this iconic, powerful image, great rhetorician, great sense of dominating a stage, knew how to stay attuned to the populace enough to be able to politically sustain himself and survive. And I mean, and he was brilliant at working the media. I mean, people go back and watch those old 60s interviews where he's riding the subway in New York and they're like, don't you have like six, you know, bodyguards and four vests? And he's like, nah, he takes his shirt off. He understood that at a level that was just totally different.
Yeah.
Played into the left's image of a revolutionary.
Absolutely.
Asserted no copyright control over Che Guevara's photo. That's why it's everywhere. It's because there's no copyright on it. Brilliant by Castro. They warned LBJ, don't kill Che, because if you do, Castro's going to make him the biggest martyr revolutionary icon in history. And they, of course, Felix Rodriguez couldn't help himself, just whacked him as soon as he could down there in Bolivia. You know, back when, you know, Klaus Barbie's hanging out just down the street, you know, whole different world. But and what did Fidel do? Next night he gave a speech, you know, brilliant speech. Let him be like Che. Let him be like Che. That created the image and icon of Che that we know today and that all these kids think is just a cool pop revolutionary. The visual image of chic revolution. So much that he's, you know, in Escape from L.A., a character
Rage
like
Rage Against the Machine. Yeah.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah.
But this regime has none of that. They don't have any of the magic and mojo, and they got all the problems and all the legacy and all the baggage.
Fantastic. Fascinating.
Absolutely fascinating.
I think the best video on Cuba that I've heard and that our viewers
are
going to see. Fantastic.
Absolutely. I mean, I for one have learned a huge amount today. I mean, I really have. I mean, about Cuba, which, as you correctly said, it's a place where there's so many myths. Everybody has their own narrative. I feel I've now really understood this a lot better than I have up to now.
Awesome. Thank you, Mr. Robert Barnes. Once again, where can people find you?
VivaBarnesLaw.locals.com.
Awesome, guys. Follow Robert Barnes on locals.com. Thank you very much, Alexander, the Oracle of London. Thank you very much. Take care, everybody.